Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today we're hearing from women who've had operations to reverse the female genital mutilation procedures performed on them. And we'll also meet one of the doctors who does the surgery.
FGM occurs between the ages of 7 and 15, so it is a very traumatic moment in their life. That's why we really believe that it's very important to approach these women and using this holistic method, because it's really something that doesn't just affect them on a physical level, but it can affect them also on a psychological level as well.
And why is Somalia's government insisting that the residents of Mogadishu rebury their dead in a hurry and at their own cost?
It's a prime line, it's a beachfront at the city centre.
Aren't there other parts of Mogadishu that would be as suitable?
Sure, there will have been other places which have been suitable. This is a question that many people are asking themselves. Why specifically this?
A deal with Turkey might provide some more answers. It's Wednesday, the 10th of July. First, we go to Ghana. Civil servants in Ghana are on strike. They've been on strike for a week now because they've been waiting for more than a year for a salary increase that was agreed 2 years ago. The civil servants union did warn the government last month that they were going to go on strike. Given that it's an election year in Ghana, I think it's safe to say they may have been expecting a response. When they heard nothing back, they launched the strike on the 3rd of July. We'll be hearing how this is affecting ordinary people, but let's first find out how it came to this. I've been discussing the background to the strike with Favour Nunu, our correspondent in Ghana.
The strike is currently ongoing. It's been on for a week now, and it looks like the civil service and local government workers are not ready to budge until government has given them a firm response in respect of their demands for the implementation of the salary agreements that went on in 2022. So the strike continues unabated.
So remind us of the agreement that they made in January 2022. It was called a Memorandum of Understanding. What were the terms? What were the conditions?
So in 2022, government entered a memorandum of understanding with the civil service workers in respect of their salaries. Most of them had salaries that were pegged so low, sometimes 40% less than what other civil service workers were earning. And this was a particular group of people who were local government and civil service. Now, the agreement was to shore up their salaries by a percentage that puts them at almost level pegging with what other civil service workers earn. But these workers who are on strike are those who work with offices like the Registrar General's Department, Bethware, they issue births and death certificates. Some of them work with hospitals as administrators, amongst other things. And so they're asking for heavy or at least more than 50% salary increments. However, that has not seen the light of day. While the agreement happened, government has not quite implemented it, and it's been over a year and a half now. And so they are now putting through the demand to force government to come through with the implementation plan that was discussed and make sure that they get their due and their salaries are shored up as planned in 2022 in the MOU that was signed.
So the agreement was meant to come into effect last year, January. What's happened between then and now?
So between then and now, one can say that government has been almost radio silent on the agreement. They haven't quite implemented it. The expectation was that they were going to sort out their finances and implement this decision. However, that hasn't quite happened. And you can understand why this is the case. Now, Ghana has been going through one of the worst financial crises in a generation. Inflation as of 2022 December hit a record high of 54%. And now, if you consider the fact that there's inflation, government coffers was nearly empty in 2023. It needed to go to the IMF in June, July, thereabout, for a bailout. It literally did not have the finances to be able to put through that increment in the wage bill. And so they have been silent and they've not been able to implement it. But that's not what the workers are interested in. For them, an agreement has been signed, and regardless of whether or not government has the resources to be able to put this through, they are asking for their due.
And how is the effect of the strike being felt? You know, when dustbin workers go on strike, you can see it immediately. When bus drivers go on strike or train drivers, people are stranded. What's happening in this particular case? It's civil servants, right?
So the impact has been felt nationwide. It's almost palpable. We have government offices and agencies and their activities grinding to a halt. In fact, we had the opportunity to engage some of them at the offices that we visited, and here's what they had to say.
I actually came to do like a fresh registration and also do change of auditors, file annual returns and all that. I didn't know they were on strike, only for me to get here today, and they're actually not here. So I don't know what I'm going to tell my people behind, though, but I mean, I have to go and relay the information to them. It has affected my time, energy, effort, and everything.
I'm coming from Christ Family Covenant, and then we are doing some documentation on our church, whatever. We are left with the last thing to do, and then you came, and then they told us that they have gone for strike. And I just called my pastor, Dr. Solomon Ata Blampa, and he was very disappointed.
It's really affecting me negatively because I was supposed to go for my children's birth cert. They gave me last week to come for their birth cert. I was told that they're on strike, so I have to wait when they resume before I can come over and get my birth cert. You know, civil servants, it's made up of a lot of ministries, so the government should address their grievances so that they can go back to work.
So, Favour, those are people that you spoke to at a government office. What's interesting to me is that, firstly, they didn't know that this was happening, and so they're being frustrated in their normal business. So is the strike just not publicised, or what's going on? Why do people not know, and if it's been going on for a week already?
The strike is publicised. However, you would understand that it's an election year in Ghana, and so there are big electoral issues that obviously are within the news domain, and so not so many people are so keen on following other events that are happening. However, for most people, it's now beginning to go, you know, down the masses that there is a strike that's happening. And so if you have any need for a service at any ministry, government agency, or municipal office, you had better stay away because you just go there. And for most of these people, it's frustrating to go through heavy transport and traffic and having to now arrive at the point you have an appointment and to only be told at the gates because you're not even be allowed into the premises that they are on strike. And so there's no business over there for you. You'd have to go back home.
So is there broad support for this strike then? And given that it's an election year, does that lend a kind of urgency to the government reaching a satisfying conclusion to this?
Indeed, this does not send a good signal to the electorates. There is broad support for it. The workers who are striking have made a strong claim about poor salaries and the fact that living standards are already high, and so their salaries cannot even match up to they living a decent kind of lifestyle. And so that's really what they are calling for. And there is broad support for it, not just for civil service workers, but then also there are other organizations and groups who have equally proceeded on strike or are planning to do so. And this is not good for government in terms of image and the optics in the running towards elections.
That's Favour Nunu, our correspondent in Accra. Our next story might be a difficult listen for some people, so do take care. We're talking about female genital mutilation. It's something that affects millions of women and girls. In fact, a United Nations report says more than 230 million people alive today are living with the effects of female genital mutilation. In Africa alone, more than 140 million people have undergone the procedure, which is often painful, traumatic, and sometimes life-threatening. A French urologist, Dr. Pierre Foldez, has developed a reconstructive procedure which has given these women and girls hope. The surgery is expensive and it is not even available in many of the countries where the practice is most prevalent. But doctors have been working on different methods to restore the damage done by FGM. We'll meet one of them in a moment, but let's hear first the experiences of women who've been through female genital mutilation. Shamsa Arawelo was just 6 when she was cut in Somalia, where it is believed that FGM guarantees the virginity of young women. She had the surgery in Germany last year when she was 30 years old.
It is important for me to speak about my experience with FGM reconstruction surgery because I know that this information does not exist. I know that there's no research of survivors after reconstruction surgery. So I wanted to be an example for all the women survivors who were going to embark on the journey of having FGM reconstruction surgery. I need them to know what it consists of because it's part of education. And not just the wider community education, but survivors, they need this education. At the time, I had a lot of chronic pain. I was in a lot of discomfort. My mental health was, getting worse. So I didn't really know where to put myself or what to do with myself, which was very difficult. It took me a year to make contact with the doctor because I was terrified of the idea of being recut, having to spread my legs wide open, be put to sleep, and I couldn't fight to defend myself, which is very weird because why would you need to defend yourself against a doctor? But for me, it wasn't just about the doctor. It was the cut. It was being recut again that I couldn't get my head, to agree with it. So eventually I made contact with Dr. O'Day. Within that year, I did do a lot of research. And finally, when I got to meet him, I made the decision right then that obviously I will go through with the surgery. And it went from there, really. And yeah, I was scared, but I still did it. It was a lot. It was so much. I can't even put it into words how difficult it was for me mentally because I'm a single parent, single lone parent. So yes, I was worried about the possible complications. And then I was worried about my daughter and having to leave the country. And where am I going to stay? Is it going to be comfortable? And is it going to work? It was just very, very stressful, I'm not going to lie. And there was nobody to help me with that. But also I was excited to never feel pain again. It was horrible, absolutely horrible. Oh my God, listen, I could have done without FGM in my life. I really could have done without any of my traumas in my life, to be honest with you. But this particular surgery had a massive toll on me, both mentally, emotionally, physically, and financially. I was broke. I had nothing. Yes, I'm a social activist. Yes, I am known, but I have nothing. So I had to literally be at the mercy of the general public. And the general public cared enough for me to help me. However, just before the surgery, I realized that I miscalculated. So I put everything that I possibly could need under 25K, including with the 25K was going to be, for my recovery as well to help me. But nope, 26,100 and something euros was just the hospital and the surgery. In that cost, there's also any complications that might arise, any additional medication that you may need at the hospital, but it doesn't include medication outside of the hospital. I was able to pay whatever I had that I had already prepared, and now I owe 3,800 euros. So you could imagine how much this has hit for me. I was not prepared to be in debt, even though the debt might not seem that much, but I can't breathe because of it. No survivor should be in debt. It's not fair. And this is why my voice is going to be even louder, because everything that I had gone through because of this surgery, I do not want them to go through it. Because it is the most inhumane thing that I've ever experienced. Oh, this is emotionally draining. I have to,
be a voice, be an example, but then have to struggle in your own life because now you are in debt with no aftercare, no one to support you. It is very difficult, very, very difficult.
You have to be mentally prepared for this surgery. I was someone who was affected by FGM, so now that I have something I haven't had for 24 odd years, then it's, you know, unusual, and you think, ugh, and you cringe, and, you know, and there's ways to combat that. Put a mirror in front of you, for example. Really look at it. Help your mind connect with your new vulva. Oh, yep, it's new, but this is yours. Survivors are human beings. We are not things to be described, and then all that has ever been described is, oh my God, the day that she was cut. Oh, it sounds so horrible. But you know what's a nightmare? Living with it is a nightmare. And I know what it feels like to live with it.
Shamsa Arawelo, who now lives in the UK and is an anti-FGM activist. But not every surgery goes well. Haja Bilkisu is a German citizen from Sierra Leone, and she has had more than one reconstruction procedure. This is her story.
The first time I started thinking about the surgery was, I think, when I was like 16 or 17 years of age. You know, when you're in puberty, you do think about stuff like that, about your body changes, and you want to belong to the group to the majority, because I didn't grow up in my home country. I grew up somewhere where it's not common to do this practice of FGM. So I just started doing my research. I found out that there is a surgery. But it took another almost 10 years for me to actually do it. And I just started to really deal with myself, deal with my trauma, and also take myself serious. What do I want from life? I wanted to be more active. I wanted also to protest against a culture that was enforced on me and on my body. And it just came to a point where I knew this is the time for me now. I'm strong enough. I'm independent. I have time by myself. I can just do the surgery and no one really has to know about it, because back then I surely wasn't ready to share this experience with my family. So I also had to wait until I was old and mature enough and didn't live at home anymore. You have to be sure that the doctor that you choose knows what he or she is doing. I had several surgeries. I had like two surgeries that were really good. The financial stuff was very easy for me because I live in Germany. I'm a German citizen, so I have the proper health insurance. And in Germany, this reconstructive surgery is not seen as plastic surgery. So it's like a mandatory surgery in order to make sure that you are healthy. So therefore, my health insurance covered everything. The only thing that I had to pay was actually laying in the hospital bed. That's really a minor price that you have to pay for every day while you're in the hospital. I had lengthy surgery. For me, each surgery took like around 6 hours. That's also tough on your body, of course. You're put under anesthesia. You have to take medication afterwards. Of course, the only thing that was a bit annoying is after you were operated on, there's natural swelling happening. So I couldn't walk for 3 weeks. So that's not that easy to go through that. But despite the discomfort, I felt empowered. I was treated with dignity. That's also very important. And of course, there were some students, medical students, who just came in the room to have a look on what was operated on, but all of them introduced themselves to me. And for me, that wasn't an issue. I'm happy if there are medical students who are actually learning about the surgery, so there will be more and more help for women in the future. For me, My FGM experience is very different than most women. Mine was done in the hospital, also under anesthesia. So I don't have a clear remembrance about what actually happened to me. Also back then, I didn't feel any pain. And I was very small, I was 8. So I didn't even know what happened to me. So I didn't enter this new season of my life during the reconstruction with fear, because I never really felt the fear. I didn't even know what happened. So I was very neutral when it came to surgery, because also my FGM, it was under surgery. And for me, surgery, I don't have negative emotions when it comes to that. In the way I see it, the FGM that happened to me was bad and was wrong. But I'm happy that in my case, I didn't feel the pain thanks to anesthesia. So I always knew anesthesia is my friend, basically. So when I entered the reconstruction, I knew I don't have to be afraid of having anesthesia. I know for a lot of women, they're afraid or they feel uncomfortable because they were held down, they were pinned down and overpowered. And then they have the same fear when they go to do an operation. You're really giving your power away already for a second time, and you don't know the outcome. So for me, my psyche was different. I knew anesthesia is something that I can handle well, and I wasn't afraid of it. I think I used the operation to rewrite history, because back then a good thing like anesthesia was used to harm me. But I knew, okay, in this case, they will use the operation, they will use anesthesia in order to help me. Everyone is different, but I believe that if you went through FGM, you will be traumatized in one way or another. So you have to work on that. You have to work on yourself. You have to work on healing. Also, I believe you have to work on forgiveness and letting the past go and make peace with what happened in order to move on. So it's both part. Body is important, but also your emotion, your psychological health is very important.
Hajar Bilkisu. To find out more about the surgery and the impact it can have, I've been speaking to Dr. Reham Awad, co-founder of Restore, Egypt's first health center that offers a range of treatments for FGM survivors. And I should warn you that she does give a brief description of the medical procedures involved.
I believe we're the only center in the world that uses non-surgical modalities. We use regenerative therapy, specifically like platelet-rich plasma and amniotic fluid. We inject it basically into the clitoris or other parts of the genitalia. We found that it actually improves pain and sensation in women who we believe don't necessarily need to have clitoral reconstructive surgery.
Right. So it's got to do with the degree to which the women that you're seeing have been cut. So with some, you need much more of a surgical intervention, and with others, it doesn't have to be surgical.
Exactly.
Right. Who are the women who come to do it?
We actually see women from all over Egypt, and we also have quite a large population of refugees from Sudan and Somalia, Ethiopia, who also come to us for treatment, since we're the only center in this region of the world that provides these services. And so we usually see women from 21 up to 65, actually.
Why do the women come to you?
The three main complaints are usually either psychosexual issues or inability to reach orgasm, for example. And the third would be them being unhappy with the appearance of their genitalia.
And explain to us what psychosexual means.
There are so many complications that can happen due to FGM. One of the main ones are the psychological consequences and the sexual ones. Those meaning, like, for example, they can develop depression or anxiety, negative body image, lack of self-confidence. They would have a decreased sensation, inability to reach orgasm, pain during any form of sexual foreplay or intercourse. Usually, they're almost present in all of the women, almost. Especially here in Egypt, because FGM occurs between the ages of 7 and 15. So it's always something that they remember very clearly. So it is a very traumatic moment in their life. That's why we really believe that it's very important to approach these women and using this holistic method or multidisciplinary approach, because it's really something that doesn't just affect them on a physical level, but it can affect them also on a psychological level as well.
So they get counseling, they get an operation treatment, and then I imagine quite extensive aftercare, which includes counseling as well.
Yes. And we also provide a little bit of sexual education as well, because some of the women that come in maybe don't need any treatment and might just require some sexual education to help them understand the anatomy and the function of their genitalia in a more efficient way.
Now, these are women who have been, many of them, deeply traumatized by an operation on their very, very private parts when they were very young. And now they're going through another operation, restorative in this case.
Yes.
So you're dealing with very delicate, very deeply upset and traumatized individuals. It must be quite difficult.
It is quite difficult, but usually the experience of them when they take the decision to come to see us, it's really about them reclaiming their power over this issue. So it's about them making informative decisions about that part of their body that are positive and will help them move forward from this trauma. So that's why we encourage them to have psychological counseling if they're going to have surgery, so that they can prepare themselves mentally. For example, we don't use general anesthesia with any of our surgeries because we like our patients to be awake and in control and feeling like they are aware of everything that's going on. We ask them to bring in their favorite music, for example, if they're going to have surgery. We try to create a very positive atmosphere for them so that they can feel that this is a different experience, that it's a positive experience and one where they are reclaiming power over something that they didn't have power over before or had consent from before.
Do you get pushback from families and from the culture broadly for what you do? Because it is seen as an ingrained and entrenched part of people's culture.
The thing is, luckily enough, we haven't had any real major pushback, because usually the people who come to us are those who are really seeking treatment. And to be honest, many of the women who come to have treatment usually don't let their families know if they're not married, for example. Those who are married, though, we do found that many of them, their husbands are very supportive of this, because usually it's causing them a lot of problems within their marriage. Thankfully, until now, we haven't had much negative pushback, but it's usually because most of the families don't know that these women are having these procedures done.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
That's Dr. Riham Awad, and a longer interview can be found on the Focus on Africa podcast.
We're in the El Gharbia region in Egypt to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now to Somalia, where the government has ordered the exhumation of thousands of graves from a cemetery in the center of Mogadishu. The order to clear the Kahia Police Academy cemetery came in June, and since then, people have been scrambling to relocate the remains of their friends and relatives to other graveyards. It's estimated that more than 50,000 bodies have been buried in the public cemetery since the early 1990s. Let's hear from someone who's had to comply with this order.
I am Bashir Abdi Korane. I live in Mogadishu. We are facing a very stressful, disheartening situation caused by the Somali government. It really impacted me because my family buried my grandmother in 1995. She has been buried for 29 years, along with other members of my family. Unexpectedly, we were asked to exhume their bodies. Without any choice, this morning, we had to go and remove their bodies and spend a lot of money on it. What's bothering me is not the expenses, but culturally, religiously, and morally, and as Somalis, we are saddened by this. We are asking the government to reassess what they're doing, or we will protest against it.
So people are quite angry at this order that seemed to come out of the blue. The government says it needs the land to develop a Navy training facility along with the Turkish government in line with the 10-year-long defense pact that it signed back in February. But why is the government insisting on this particular bit of land? Abdirahman Yusuf is a Somali journalist in Nairobi. He's been providing some of the answers.
The government has stated that they want to convert the cemetery into a marine training camp for the Turkish army, and they haven't given another place or any other offer for the people to bury once they exhume their bodies in another place. Many of the people have termed this as a knee-jerk reaction and an uncalculated move, and a move that hasn't really put much into place considering how valuable the cemetery is to the Somali people.
And put them where? Do what with them?
They haven't given any option to the people. They haven't given any directive where the people are going to bury their bodies or what's going to happen next. They just issued a directive of 10 days only. They gave the people an ultimatum of 10 days to exhume their bodies at their own cost without telling them specifically where they're going to bury the bodies.
Okay, so just tell us, what are the cultural and religious difficulties that people would have in Somalia when it comes to exhumation?
Many have decried that this is a cemetery that has existed for more than decades. They can't even really tell where they are buried their people at specifically. Secondly, apart from the cultural heritage, remember, Somali, just like many other African communities, believe in spirits. It's like you're disturbing the ancestors and the spirits of the people that have already died. So it's something that really has caused uproar and grief for many residents of Mogadishu.
So have people already started with the exhumations?
Yes, some have already begun the exhumation.
And what have they done with the bodies?
They have reburied the bones at a burial of their choice.
What do you think is actually going on? Why would the government of Somalia put the interests of a Turkish training base over the interests and well-being and spiritual well-being of the people?
This has got more to do with geopolitical reasons. Remember, Somalia recently signed 10-year marine pact with Turkey, which they were forced as a result of Somaliland signing an MOU with Ethiopia. They've also faced illegal fishing and dumping of waste products by other nations. So it has got a lot of things to do with geopolitical reasons. They put the interest of the political reasons at first, other than the interest of their own citizens.
I mean, I can imagine that many of those bones won't be exhumed. Are they just going to bulldoze them out of the ground and bury them somewhere else and then continue with whatever they're going to develop? Have they said what they're going to do if people just don't remove the bodies?
Exactly. I think that's what's going to happen. Since I had already initially pointed out that many people have lamented that they cannot really remember. They buried their loved ones more than 30 years ago, so they can't even tell where their graveyard is. So many have said they're not going to exhume their bodies. So I think that's what they're going to do, exhume and excavate the bones and dispose them elsewhere.
So are people thinking of just leaving the remains there and defying the government?
Yes, many have said that they're not going to exhume the bones of their loved ones.
Thank you so much.
Okay, pleasure.
That was Abdirahman Yusuf, an independent Somali journalist based in Nairobi. Now, let me take you back to Mogadishu, where Mohamud Abdisamad, a colleague of ours, recounted the day he had to exhume three of his family members.
It was 6:30 a.m. when we went there, and there was a police in there. They were checking. What they are checking is not only for security-wise, but also they were checking for smartphones because they don't want people to record their phones, what was going there, and to spread in media or in social media. So we went there and we got workers in there. So you have to pay like $40 for them because they will help you to dig and remove your relative's body. There is another money you have to pay for ambulance, like $50 or $60. And also there is a money that you have to pay the new cemetery, which is $130. And there are some other maybe monies you can need for logistics of the relatives that you are going with you, and those kind of things. So it costs us between $200 and $300, but the government was not taking us money. A lot of people who are living in Mogadishu or in Somalia, $300 is very expensive. So you can say that also this land was government owned it, but it was difficult to a lot of people. And a lot of people was angry about that, but it seems like it's now like a month from the day we done. So we are recovering.
That's Mohamud Abdissamad from the BBC Somali Service. Focus on Africa was put together by Joseph Keane, Patricia Whitehorn and Bella Hassan in London. Frenny Joey and Susan Gashui were in Nairobi. Paul Bachibinga was the senior journalist in charge. Jack Graysmark was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are the editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Thanks for your company.
We're in the El Gharbia region in Egypt to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.